From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Andrew Solomon talks about depression, the condition in which every second of being alive hurts. At least that's how he describes his own depressions. His book, The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, has just won a National Book Award. It recounts his personal experiences and explains the biology of depression, the latest pharmaceutical and alternative treatments, and how depression is treated in different cultures. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz brings us the latest news from the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And Fresh Air critic Ken Tucker reviews Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. Investigators reportedly say they are testing a letter sent to Senator Patrick Leahy's office for possible anthrax contamination. According to broadcast reports, the letter was postmarked Trenton, New Jersey, and dated October 9th. It was discovered in a pile of mail, quarantined since the anthrax-laced letter was discovered in the Washington office of Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. The Pentagon estimates the Taliban regime has lost control of two-thirds of Afghanistan, but Rear Admiral John Stuffelbeam adds there are a number of pockets of resistance, and it is not certain just who is in control in some areas. NPR's Steve Inskeep is in Afghanistan and says Taliban forces are under fire in Kunduz.
U.S. planes have been striking the Taliban front lines outside the city of Kunduz. You could hear many planes in the sky today. And on at least one occasion, the U.S. dropped bombs near the Taliban front lines, sending up a huge plume of smoke. For the moment, Northern Alliance troops have not begun an advance into the city of Kunduz itself. The front has been static for the last few days, but civilians in the area are taking no chances. They're under pressure from the Taliban, which appears to be worried about defections from inside Kunduz itself. They're also concerned about the fighting or the possibility of fighting, and many of them are becoming refugees, fleeing the city of Kunduz and the surrounding villages and fleeing across the battle lines into Northern Alliance territory.
NPR Steve Inskeep in Afghanistan. Officials in Atlanta today evacuated some 10,000 people and grounded flights after a man ran through a security checkpoint at Atlanta's Hartsfield Airport. The airport has since reopened. The man got away. Meanwhile, the trouble is just beginning for air travelers up and down the East Coast and around the country. A bill aimed at boosting public confidence in air travel passed the House and Senate today. Both chambers overwhelmingly approved the measure and sent it to the White House. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
The aviation security bill passed the Senate on a voice vote, while in the House only 9 Republicans voted against it. House GOP leaders lost their bid to keep airport baggage and passenger screening in private hands. The Democratic-controlled Senate prevailed in its insistence that some 28,000 screeners become federal employees. Still, Republican Don Young, who chairs the House Transportation Committee, praised the final bill.
It is the best security bill this nation has ever had for the flying public. And I want the public to know that now and from now on and forevermore, that when they get on that plane, the opportunity of someone doing that dastardly deed that was done in 911 will not occur again.
All checked luggage is to be inspected within 60 days once President Bush signs the bill into law, possibly next Monday. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Stock prices were mixed on Wall Street. The Dow was down 5 points, the Nasdaq down 2. This is NPR News. In Los Angeles, 3 police officers who stood trial in connection with the Rampart Police corruption scandal have filed a lawsuit alleging malicious prosecution. NPR's Ina Jaffe has details.
Sergeants Edward Ortiz and Brian Liddy and Officer Paul Harper were tried for framing alleged gang members. Harper was acquitted on all charges, but Ortiz and Liddy were convicted on some counts. However, the guilty verdicts were overturned by the trial judge, who said she had committed an error in validating the jury's decision. The 3 officers are now suing former Los Angeles District Attorney Gil Garcetti, L.A. Police Chief Bernard Parks, and disgraced former officer Rafael Perez. He told prosecutors of an epidemic of corruption in the Rampart Division's anti-gang unit in exchange for a lighter sentence on a drug charge. According to the lawsuit, Garcetti and Parks conspired to falsely arrest and publicly humiliate the 3 officers on the word of convicted felons and liars. Meanwhile, the district attorney's office is appealing the trial judge's decision to throw out the guilty verdicts. Ina Jaffe, NPR News, Los Angeles.
A woman in Florida is suing three police deputies who planted drugs in her home. Sarah Smith lost custody of her baby daughter for 18 months when she was convicted in 1997 on drug charges. The officers were sent to prison for planting drugs on suspects, stealing money from people under arrest, and perjury. The men were part of an elite drug-fighting group called the Delta Task Force. Heavily armed police in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, took up positions at Serbia's government and police headquarters as a precaution against a renegade anti-terrorist police unit. The elite force is protesting the arrest of war criminal suspects. Loyal officers were deployed amid fears that the rebellious Red Beret might attempt to stage an armed coup. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and the Amundsen Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. This week, Andrew Solomon won the National Book Award for Nonfiction for his work The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. Solomon is what you might describe as a self-taught expert on the subject of depression. He suffers from it and has had several breakdowns. After one of his recoveries, he plunged himself into research on the condition. The Noonday Demon recounts his own experiences and those of many men and women he interviewed. It also explains the biology of depression, the latest pharmaceutical and alternative treatments, and how depression is understood and treated in different cultures. Solomon is a contributor to The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. Before we listen to Terry's interview with him, recorded this summer, let's hear a conversation Terry had with him yesterday after the book awards were announced.
Andrew Solomon, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Very nice to have your book win. Is it helping your mood to win the award?
I said last night I thought there was nothing more effective as an antidepressant than winning the National Book Award.
Were you surprised to win, and how did you find out you won?
I found out I won sitting at a dinner for 1,500 people in the Marriott Marquis in New York when they announced it from the podium. I was extremely pleased that I won. I had hoped that I might win. I'm pleased not only because it's very gratifying to one's ego and very reassuring to have that kind of response to one's work, but also because I think that even 10 years ago, a book on depression would have seemed to people almost frivolous, and that the seriousness with which the book has been treated reflects an improving national attitude toward mental illness. So I was very gratified for that reason.
Is your psychiatrist happy about it?
I've just seen my psychiatrist not half an hour ago, and he was delighted. He gave me a big hug.
Good. So I feel the need to have a kind of post-September 11th update with you before we hear the interview that we originally recorded. I'm wondering if you were writing a post-September 11th chapter in the book, what are some of the issues you might want to address in it?
Well, I would look, first of all, at how much of an increase in depression there's been around the country. Sales of antidepressants are up between 20 and 25%. People reporting anxiety disorders, numbers have gone up dramatically. There have also been increases in the rates of both domestic violence and child abuse, which I think reflects a general mental instability. I think one of the first things that I would have to say in a chapter like this is that right now people are very depressed, and they're depressed with good reason. But, you know, if you fall off a ladder and break your arm, you've broken your arm for a good reason. You fell off a ladder, but you still need to set it and you still need to take care of it. And that now looking at this post-September 11th time, there's this great crisis in American mental health, and there's a good reason for it, but we need to address it and we need to address it responsibly.
Now, what about you and friends of yours and other people who you know through your book who have more chronic problems with depression? Is terrorism making that depression worse?
The tendency right now has been for people who have had depressive episodes to relapse and to have further depressive episodes. And the tendency has also been for people who have never had depressive episodes to have them. But the worst hit population are people who have previously suffered from depression. And though I'm doing fairly well now, I have to say in the period immediately after September 11th, I was aware of a sort of profound feeling of instability and unsafety that was just overwhelming to me. And part of it was the appropriate response to what had happened, and then part of it was spinning out of control so that I felt there was no point doing my work, there was no point connecting with other people, everything felt futile, everything felt desperate. That part, I think, is the depression part.
What do you think got you out of that?
I increased the dose of one of the medications I was on, only for 10 days, but it helped to pull me through that trough. And as time passed, I adjusted to the new reality, and that also helped. And I think I focused very hard on trying to think through rationally what I was experiencing and trying to gain some kind of knowledge and control over it.
And is this something you've been talking about a lot with friends and professional contacts?
Yes, I've been discussing it with professional people. I've done consulting in several occasions, including recently at Columbia University, on how to address the current crisis. And I've just been amazed by how many people have written to me or sent me emails or come up to me when I've done public appearances to say, you know, I had a depression once and I thought everything was okay, but just since September 11th, I've been feeling really terrible. I hear that over and over and over again. Or I was okay even with September 11th, but with this anthrax stuff, I just feel afraid all the time. I don't want to leave my house. And again, I feel like the point at which it prevents people from functioning is the point at which it crosses over into clinical territory. And I do hear a lot about people not functioning well, people getting to work, starting on something, getting partway through it, and then thinking, who cares whether this magazine comes out, or who cares whether this contract gets closed?
Do you have any advice?
My advice is to take your emotional temperature carefully, and if you feel as though you actually are becoming depressed, don't write it off just because there is an occasion for the depression. Instead, go to see a mental health professional. Consider taking medication if you haven't taken it before, or adjusting your dosage if you're on medication. Consider various kinds of talking therapies, but don't expect the depression to just go away magically when we win the war in Afghanistan. I think once it's been triggered, it's a serious matter and it has to be dealt with seriously. And I don't think the changes in current events will necessarily snap everyone back into perfect condition.
Well, Andrew Solomon, I wish you the best through this difficult period, and I congratulate you again on winning the National Book Award. And in a moment, we'll listen back to the interview that we recorded together in early June when your book was first published. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Now let's hear the interview with Andrew Solomon from last June. Terry asked him if he'd found any solace in seeing how widespread depression is, or in better understanding the nature of it.
There's been considerable solace in understanding depression better. I think the more one knows about it, the more one feels in control of what happens, and the better informed one is about depression, the more one recognizes what one goes through. The extent of depression was the thing that I think most startled and surprised me as I began working on this book. If you go to parties and say to people that you're writing a book about depression, as long as there's a group of people, everyone laughs. But people begin to take you aside as soon as you're with them one-on-one, and everybody I met has some kind of a depression story. Either their own affliction or the afflictions of people who are close to them. It's just the family secret everyone has. It's a universal phenomenon.
I'd like to ask you to describe your experience of depression. Why don't we do the most extreme form of depression, the breakdown, and you've had a couple of them.
I have. I had my first really severe breakdown in about 1994. I had been going along about my life, and I'd been through some things that were quite traumatic and quite difficult, the most striking one being the death of my mother at the end of a long battle with cancer. And I was feeling very down and very blue and rather grief-stricken. I had some additional personal traumas. And then I began to feel really increasingly sad. And then I began to feel sort of numb. And then I began to find that things were just a little bit effortful, and that I didn't seem to be able to muster very much emotion about anything. And then things began to become more effortful, and I would get home and have messages on my answering machine, and I would think, all those people, I need to call back all of those people. And I would think, I have to go out, and I have to get things to eat, and I have to get through the day, and it all seemed like somehow more than I could manage to do. And I thought that was very strange, but I was still able to keep up a facade of functioning reasonably well, and I assumed that it was just a temporary thing, and I didn't really pay very much attention to it. And then it began to get more severe, and I began to have this feeling of dread and anxiety, which was sort of like the feeling you might have if you had tripped and you were about to fall, that sort of middle-of-the-air feeling before you quite hit the ground. But it was extended, and this feeling of dread got worse and worse, and I began coming home and hearing messages on my answering machine and thinking, not simply that I didn't want to call people back, but that I didn't know how I ever could. I would think, who are those people? How am I ever going to catch up with them? What am I ever going to do? How am I going to... And they were just messages from friends and people who wanted to be in touch. And I would think, I have to get dressed. I have to put on my clothes. I have to put on both socks. I have to put on both shoes. And the whole business of ordinary daily life began to seem so effortful and so overwhelming. And I really didn't understand what was happening to me, but I kept trying to battle through it, still thinking, this doesn't make any sense. This is so weird. And then I became more and more anxious and more null. And I had more and more this feeling that was a mix of sadness and fear until finally I felt I simply couldn't do anything. And I found myself at last lying in bed one day thinking, I can't get up. And I lay there thinking, I can't put the toothpaste on my toothbrush. I can't brush all of my teeth. It just seemed like such an overwhelming task. It seemed much more frightening and much more overwhelming than at this point it seems to me, for example, to come and do an interview on National Public Radio. And I thought, how am I going to get out of bed? And I lay there in bed just shaking with fear and feeling completely unable to do anything and feeling no emotion of any kind except that fear and anxiety. And I thought, I have to call someone. I have to get out of my apartment. And I couldn't reach for the telephone. I lay there staring at the telephone thinking, you just pick it up and you dial. But I simply couldn't do it. And fortunately, someone called me and I said, something has gone terribly, terribly wrong with me. And at that point, I started going to see a psychopharmacologist and trying to do something and begin to emerge.
Now, you say in your book that people are often relieved when a doctor says, your depression is chemically based. When you learned about the biology of depression, was that any comfort to you? Did it make you think, well, now this will be easier to overcome?
Well, certainly when I realized that what I had could be explained in part biologically and that it could be treated in part biologically, that was a great comfort. But as I continued to work on the book and as I continued to work with my own personality and depression, I came to believe that everything about us is to some extent chemically based and that personality is chemically based. And some of the time I think people say depression is chemically based as a sort of way out. I think you can use chemical treatments to ameliorate depression, but I think depression itself is a very complex phenomenon. It's chemically based. It's also a part of who you are and a part of your character.
I'd like you to run through some of the pills, for instance, that you're taking now and what they're supposed to do for you in terms of changing your body chemistry or alleviating panic.
Well, my primary antidepressant now is Effexor, which I expect that I'll be taking for a long time. It manages to keep me from getting to that low level of being genuinely dysfunctional. It does not prevent me from being sad, but it prevents me from getting overwhelmingly sad for absolutely no reason whatsoever in the way I did when I was depressed. Then I also take Buspar, which has a mild anti-anxiety effect. And then I take Wellbutrin, which is helpful in allaying some of the antisexual side effects of the Effexor. I take Zyprexa, which is a mild anti-anxiety drug, which is also used for psychosis, though I don't take it for psychosis. And then I also take Topamax, because the Zyprexa tends to cause weight gain, and the Topamax, which is a mood stabilizer, tends to prevent the weight gain. So it's a very delicately balanced cocktail.
You must feel very dependent on these pills and very afraid to not be without them.
I feel very dependent on them, and I sort of hate being dependent on them, but I just feel so relieved every time I look at that handful of pills and think, okay, if I take these, that horrible business of depression won't happen to me again.
Andrew Solomon's book on depression is The Noonday Demon. It just won the National Book Award. We'll hear more of our interview with him after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to Terry Gross's interview with Andrew Solomon, author of The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression.
You've had psychiatrists who did talk therapy with you and others who took a more pharmacological approach. Are you still combining the two?
Yes, I am, and I think I will permanently. And my biggest piece of advice to people who are going through a depression is to use a combination of therapies. I think too often people want to take medication and not think too much about their own personalities. I think there's strong statistical evidence now that a combination of talking therapy and medication is much more effective than either one of those treatments alone. I think that when you've had a depression, you really have to come to a new understanding of who you are. I think one of the urgent messages of the Noonday Demon is that depression feels, while you're in it, and is while you're in it, a bleak, empty, barren experience. But in fact, when you've come out of it, there are many lessons that can be learned from depression. It's an enormously intense experience. It involves a kind of emotion that you don't necessarily experience anywhere else in life. And part of what I would like to do is to help people to find, in retrospect, whatever richness or whatever depth can be extracted from depression. And I think going through talking therapy is one of the ways in which you can discover those things about your personality that you might never have known if you hadn't been through this particular devastation.
What's an example of something like that that you discovered after one of your depressions?
I feel like I became a kinder person because of the depression that I'd been through. I became more empathetic. And in addition, I think I discovered a joyfulness about daily life.
Yeah, but at the same time, don't you feel this dread that at any moment the depression might come back?
Yes, there's a constant dread of it. And depression is a cyclical and a recurrent illness. And what we have for depression now are treatments rather than cures. Once you have really serious depression, you're never completely free of it. And that can be a terrible burden, is a terrible burden.
What are some of the things that you feel you get out of talking to a psychiatrist that you wouldn't get if you were just taking drugs?
I think you come to an understanding of what the predisposing factors are to depression so that when you begin to move toward what might be a depression episode, you can recognize it much better and much more quickly. You can decide whether you ought to increase some of your medications or shift some of your medications or do something about them. You can recognize behaviors of your own that seem to trigger some of your depressive episodes, because a depressive episode usually is linked both to life events and to chemical shifts in the brain. You come to understand yourself better and more profoundly. You understand how you move toward depression in the course of your ordinary life. You recognize the kinds of events that trigger your depression. You learn how to regulate your own emotional life and to have greater control over what happens in your emotional interior so that you can steer clear of depressions. You gain greater and more profound self-knowledge. And I think part of what happens in depression also is that you experience a terrible aloneness. And I think in a really successful therapy, you have not only the company of the therapist, which has a certain value, but you also learn more and more about how to connect deeply and truly and honestly with other people, with the people who are your friends or the people you're married to or the members of your family, and that by learning how to have those connections be more profound, less troubled, and less ambivalent, you develop the kind of connectedness and the kind of absence of aloneness that are extremely useful in staving off the recurrence of depression and that make it easier if you go into a depression to battle your way back out of it.
Does your particular brand of depression come along with a degree of self-loathing?
When I'm in the depression itself, it absolutely comes with self-loathing. I mean, part of what you experience during a depressive episode is a sense that your life is worthless and has no value. You begin to feel suicidal, and part of that suicidality is thinking, I'm worthless. I'm useless. My life is useless. The world would be just as well if I weren't in it. Yes, absolutely, that's a big part of what happens.
Have you found that talk therapy has helped you through that feeling of hating yourself?
I have found that it's been very helpful in establishing really a rational platform that I can oppose to the emotional feelings that come washing over me. Even if I feel emotionally as though I'm worth nothing, I have a rational piece of my mind which keeps saying, now you know perfectly well that you have great value, that you have people around you, that there are very good reasons to live. I think it's important to have a good base established so that your rational mind retains a certain validity when your emotional mind seems to come washing over it with all of that negativity. And it's part of what I hope the book is able to do, is to give people a sense of how to establish that rational control so that their emotional mind doesn't completely colonize the rest of their brain.
Through your book, you quote several poems about depression. Some of them are from people who you know. Others are from Emily Dickinson, Jane Kenyon. I thought it might be nice if you read us one of your favorites that you've collected.
I think that the one that always seemed to me to be the most compelling description of depression is Emily Dickinson. It's the poem, "I Felt a Funeral in My Brain." I felt a funeral in my brain, and mourners to and fro kept treading, treading, till I thought that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service like a drum kept beating, beating, till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift a box and creak across my soul with those same boots of lead again. Then space began to toll, as if the heavens were a bell, and being were an ear, and I and silence, some strange race wrecked solitary here. Just then, a plank in reason broke, and I fell down and down and hit a world at every plunge, and finished knowing then. There we are.
I should mention, you know that one by heart. That was not something you read from the page. That one you just know. In writing about your own depression, you talk about how when you're very, very depressed, every minute hurts. And it strikes me as being so similar and at the same time opposite to the whole idea of meditation, where you strive for living exactly in the moment. But you're living exactly in the moment when you're depressed. You say there's no past and there's no future. All there is the pain of the present.
I think that's actually an incredibly good parallel, and I'd never heard it phrased quite that way. One of the people I interviewed said to me that she felt like it was that moment when your fingers get slammed in a car door and you're just stalled forever in that exact instant. But yes, it is a feeling of incredible, constant pain. And you think to yourself, not how am I going to get through the next 20 years, but how am I going to get through the next second of being alive?
Andrew Solomon's book, The Noonday Demon, is this year's winner of the National Book Award for Nonfiction. We'll continue Terry Gross's interview with him in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Elektra Entertainment, whose releases include Natalie Merchant's new album, Motherland, natalie-merchant.com, or AOL keyword Natalie Merchant. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publishers of Stephen Hawking's The Universe in a Nutshell, a sequel to A Brief History of Time. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz on music from the Boston Symphony Orchestra archives and the controversy that has BSO in the news. Also, Harry Potter comes to the screen. We have a review. And we continue our interview with Andrew Solomon, who just received the National Book Award.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. And we're back with Terry's interview with Andrew Solomon, author of The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. This week it won the National Book Award for Nonfiction. It's about the biology of depression, the latest pharmaceutical and alternative treatments, how depression is dealt with in different cultures, and Solomon's own experience of the condition.
Part of your book is devoted to your mother's suicide, and you also wrote a New Yorker article about that. Your mother had ovarian cancer, and she was very, very sick during her final chemotherapy. You describe her mouth as being one big sore. She could hardly eat. She had no strength. She'd become allergic to nearly everything. Life was hell, and she wanted to end it. She asked the family to help her commit suicide and to be with her as she did it. Her plan was to take secondals, an overdose on that, which is what she did. How did she explain wanting to involve you in her suicide as opposed to just doing it and having you find out about it after the fact?
She said that she didn't want to go through the final indignities of dying in a hospice or in a hospital. She was someone who had always very much cherished dignity and control. At the time that she killed herself, she had been told by doctors that she was not treatable, that she had a clearly terminal cancer, and that she had very little time left to live. So it was a matter of dying only a few months before she would otherwise have died in much more extreme circumstances of pain. And she said that she considered committing suicide all on her own, but she felt that it would be terribly upsetting for us to find her dead and not to know what had really happened and not to understand. And she said she felt she wanted to die quietly and peacefully at home, and she wanted us to feel that we'd been with her at the end and to understand that this was not something she'd done in despair or something she'd done in anger or something she'd done because she couldn't manage to get through what lay ahead of her, but rather something she'd done because she wanted peace and quiet and dignity, and that for her it was the right choice and a happy choice, and that she had things she wanted to say to us right before she went. And indeed, she had an extraordinary death scene, which I describe in the book, which concluded with her looking at my father and my brother and me and saying, "I want you to know that in the course of my life, I have looked for many things, so many things, and all the time, paradise has been in this room with the three of you." And then she closed her eyes for the last time. And it was a very moving and very compelling circumstance. And it was very difficult to watch her die. We didn't exactly assist her. We were just present while she did it. But I think it was probably, for all the trauma that was involved, a better way for me to see her go than to see her emaciated and in pain in a hospital bed, the way that I've seen other friends die of cancer.
You quote what your mother said to you just before she died. And she said, "Don't think you're paying me some kind of great tribute if you let my death become the great event of your life. The best tribute you can pay to me as a mother is to go on and have a good and fulfilling life. Enjoy what you have." That's really beautiful advice. Did you try to follow that?
It took me a while. I mean, as I said, there were a number of life circumstances that precipitated my depression. The loss of my mother, to whom I'd been extremely close, was one. The end of a relationship that I'd been involved with was another. I went through extreme physical pain with a very bad case of kidney stones. There were a whole catalog of other things with which I will not bore our listeners today. They all led into a depression. The depression was very severe, and so there was a period, certainly, when the bad things that had happened to me were the subject of my life. But some people have said to me since, "Well, how did you fight your way back out of your depression? And how did you get to the point at which you were able to write a book about it? And how did you get to the point at which you were living a life that you found rich and rewarding and interesting?" And I have to say those words were in the back of my mind a lot. I felt as though one has a limited number of days on earth and one has to struggle to get to the point at which one lives them well. One of the things that I found astonishing when I was working on this book is that there are some people who have got really relatively slight symptoms by their own description of depression, but whose depression somehow devastates and ruins their lives and becomes the only thing that there is in their lives. And there are other people who have got symptoms that are unbelievably extreme and that are almost intolerably painful, but who somehow, in between episodes and around episodes, manage nonetheless to have lives in which they really connect with other people and lives in which they themselves see considerable value. And I became fascinated by the borderline between personality and illness. Now, I don't particularly hold myself up as an example, but I do hold some of the people who are in the book up as examples of those who are able, one way or another, to have rich lives despite their depression, You can't have a rich life during your depression. And it's a terrible mistake to take someone who's in a depression and say, well, pull yourself together. Life is wonderful. Life is meaningful. Get some of the richness out of life right now, despite what you're going through. But I think it's very important for people who experience depression to spend the time when they're in depression thinking of what complexity life has to offer, and when they begin to come out, to try to grab onto the things that will offer some meaning in their lives. That, I think, is the message of hope that there is in the end in this book.
To just hold on till it's over, till that depression is over.
To hold on till the depression is over, but then when the depression is over, to come to terms with the depression, not to turn your back on it, not to run away from it, and not to allow the shadow of it to take over the rest of your life.
You mentioned that you went to different cultures, different countries, to understand depression there. You went to Cambodia. This is after the killing fields, after Pol Pot had practically performed genocide on his own people. The amazing thing there is that not everybody is depressed, that some people kind of carry on without depression. What are some of the things that your experiences looking at depression in Cambodia made you realize about depression?
Well, one is that I realized that people are incredibly resilient. I mean, I discovered as I looked around at the world that there are some people who are in poverty-stricken countries, who have had entire families die in famine, who have been through the most unbelievable, horrendous circumstances, and who nonetheless absolutely cling to life, who you see sort of doing whatever they can, eating whatever comes to hand just in order to stay alive. And I thought, look at all of the people who commit suicide in the most supportive and prosperous and comfortable societies on earth. There is a difference between the people who are subject to depression and the people who seem not to be subject to depression. But in Cambodia in particular, I had a really amazing experience with a woman who treats depressed people in Cambodia and who described how she worked with survivors of the Khmer Rouge who were severely depressed. And she said she tried to work with them in three stages. She said they all were people whose minds were so crowded with horror that they could barely get up and function. She said there were women who had been through these terrible traumas of the Khmer Rouge period and couldn't take care of their own children because they were simply disabled to the point at which they didn't feed the infants who were sitting next to them. She said, and I tried to teach them three things. She said, first, I tried to teach them to forget. And I did that by asking them to remember what had happened, to talk to me about it, and then to talk about other things so that I could begin to fill up their mind with some other things that would take up some of the space that was taken up with their terrible memories. And then after they had begun to forget, I tried to teach them to work. Sometimes all they would be able to do was to clean up their own houses and maybe to gather firewood in the jungle, she said, whatever it was, but I would teach them to do something so they had something they could start and do and say, this was my thing and I did it today, she said. And then, because I was working with groups of women, mostly in resettlement camps, she said, I taught them to perform manicures and pedicures. And I said, you taught them what? She said, the women of Cambodia who had been through these experiences had been in a country in which half the country turned against the other half of the country. And I taught them to do this because it was a system in which they touched each other's hands and feet in a way that was at once intimate and non-threatening. And in doing that, they began to talk to each other. And they were enjoying the idea that they were being made somehow more beautiful while they did it, she said, and it taught them to begin to open up to other people and to trust again. And when they had learned to forget and to work and to trust, then I tried to teach them that those three activities were not separate, but were part of a single sensibility. And when they had learned that, they were ready to go into the world again. And as I listened to what she was saying, I had a sense that here was a culture that was really quite foreign and quite different from American culture, and a society that had been through enormous traumas, but that the basic building blocks of reconstructing personalities that had been ripped apart by going through such enormous trauma were really quite similar to the ones that people go through using very sophisticated Western techniques of psychotherapy.
Andrew Solomon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Andrew Solomon is the author of The Noonday Demon, which just won the National Book Award for Nonfiction. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz on the Boston Symphony Orchestra. This is Fresh Air. four of the five major American symphony orchestras in New York, Philadelphia, Cleveland, and Boston have been undergoing major upheavals in leadership, but none more radical than the 121-year-old Boston Symphony Orchestra. But classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that's not the only music story coming from Boston.
Seiji Ozawa is leaving at the end of this season after having been music director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra for 29 years, longer than any other conductor. He'll be taking over the Vienna State Opera, which is one of the few positions in the classical music world that might be considered even more prestigious. On the other hand, James Levine, who has been leading the Metropolitan Opera for 30 years, now wants to devote himself more seriously to the symphonic repertoire and has agreed to come to Boston, where his handful of BSO concerts, unlike most of Ozawa's, have been major artistic successes. One of the reasons he said he wanted to perform in Boston is Symphony Hall, which is one of the concert world's acoustical marvels. In celebration of the hall's centennial, the BSO has just released a 12-CD set from its archive of live radio broadcasts, a disc each to former music directors, Serge Koussevitzky, Pierre Monteux, Charles Munch, Erich Leinsdorf, and William Steinberg, two discs to Ozawa, four discs of such diverse guest conductors as Leopold Stokowski, Aaron Copland, Guido Cantelli, and Klaus Tennstedt, but not Levine, and a disc of encore pieces and bits of rehearsals with Koussevitzky and Leonard Bernstein. Followers of the BSO might argue about the selections or the conductors themselves, but no question, the best things here are extraordinary mementos of a great orchestra. That's Koussevitzky conducting one of the masterpieces of 20th century music, Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra, which Koussevitzky himself commissioned for the BSO. It's the first broadcast performance, December 30th, 1944, barely a month after its world premiere. I also love hearing the great French conductor Pierre Monteux in some unfamiliar repertoire for him, like these stylishly Viennese waltzes from Richard Strauss's opera Der Rosenkavalier. For a relatively conservative organization, the BSO has had its share of controversy. Back in 1982, the orchestra invited Vanessa Redgrave to narrate a production of Stravinsky's Oedipus Rex, directed by the brilliant young Peter Sellers. But the BSO canceled the performances, claiming it feared angry protesters against Redgrave's pro-Palestinian position. The events of September 11th have also led to changes in BSO programs. This month, Robert Spano was scheduled to conduct the choruses from John Adams' opera, The Death of Klinghoffer, with a libretto by Alice Goodman about the Palestinian terrorist attack on the Italian cruise ship Achille Lauro, in which a Jewish American, Leon Klinghoffer, was murdered, then tossed overboard in his wheelchair. These seven choral sections contain some of Adams's most eloquent music, several depicting natural forces, ocean and desert, night and day, and two in the voices of Jewish and Palestinian exiles, both given equal time. Here are excerpts from the choruses of exiled Palestinians and exiled Jews on a new Nonesuch John Adams CD conducted by Kent Nagano. Both Robert Spano and the BSO management now feel that this is an inappropriate time to perform passages from a work about a terrorist act, especially since the husband of one of the chorus members was a victim of the September 11th attacks. But Adams and Goodman strongly disagree with this decision. "The time for escapism is past," Goodman has said. It's hard to sort this out. This piece has from its inception been difficult, controversial material. It would surely have been painful to perform and painful to hear right now. but I'm worried about an attitude that wants to protect audiences from confronting painful subjects, especially when that subject has such immediate relevance to what we're all living through.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. His latest book of poems is Cairo Traffic. Coming up, Harry Potter on the big screen. This is Fresh Air. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone opens today. The novels about this young wizard have sold over 120 million copies in 46 languages, and so it's no surprise that the film version of the first in the series is the most anticipated premiere of the season for many people. Ken Tucker, who has read the books with his children, went to see the movie. Here's his review.
J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books are small wonders of contemporary pop culture. Hugely popular works of genuine literary merit, wildly imaginative children's stories that also delve headlong into the nature of family, love, loyalty, and evil. This is important to remember right now, when the hype over the $125 million movie Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone might make some people feel like Jonathan Franzen in the land of Oprahs, suspicious that books chosen by so many millions of readers, adults as well as kids, couldn't be that good, could they? Well, the books are. The movie isn't quite. As an adaptation of the first book in Rowling's series, the film has the difficult task of introducing a multitude of characters and the creation of an alternate world. Hogwarts, a magical boarding school for the training of wizards. Harry, played by the young British actor Daniel Radcliffe, is a young orphan with a jagged scar on his forehead that brands him as the most powerful wizard of all. But when we first meet him, he's just a hapless boy leading a miserable existence with his unloving aunt and uncle in a drab corner of London. Harry is summoned to Hogwarts by its headmaster, Albus Dumbledore, played here with a very long white beard by Richard Harris. This is every miserable child's fantasy, to be whisked away from adults who don't understand you and taken to a land where everyone recognizes your uniqueness. Harry quickly makes two close friends, the bookish Hermione Granger and the mischievous Ron Weasley, superbly embodied by Emily Watson and Rupert Grint. And he gains a bodyguard of sorts in the gentle giant Hagrid, played by Robbie Coltrane, whom cable TV viewers will know as the considerably more dissolute mystery solver called Cracker. The screenplay is by Steve Close, who's proved he could be wittily adroit at transferring literature to the big screen last year with the Michael Douglas film Wonder Boys. Wit and adroitness are not, however, adjectives that spring to mind when considering the director of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, Chris Columbus. Columbus gave us the Home Alone movies and the Robin Williams cross-dressing opus Mrs. Doubtfire. He makes big, obvious movies whose tones could not be more antithetical to J.K. Rowling's sly, glancing one. The Sorcerer's Stone of the title is a craggy jewel that's a source of immense magical energy. It's being sought by the book's embodiment of ultimate evil, Lord Voldemort, and must be kept from him by Harry and his pals.
Hagrid!
Oh, hello. Sorry, don't wish to be rude, but I'm in no fit state to entertain today.
We know about the Sorcerer's Stone!
Oh.
We
think Snape's trying to steal it.
Snape? Blimey, you're not still on about him, are you?
Hagrid, we know he's after the stone, we just don't know why.
Snape is one of the teachers protecting the stone. He's not about to steal it.
What?
You heard. Right, come on now, I'm a bit preoccupied today.
Wait a minute. One of the teachers?
Of course. There are other things defending the stone, aren't there? Spells, enchantments.
That's right. Waste of bloody time, if you ask me. Ain't no one going to get past Fluffy. Ain't a soul knows how, except for me and Dumbledore. I shouldn't have told you that.
Director Chris Columbus has made a movie solely for young kids. He's drained off the pleasure older children and adults get from Rowling's juicy jokes and English boarding school parodies. The director's one visual triumph is a Quidditch match, a sort of airborne combination of hockey, rugby, and polo played on broomsticks. Columbus captures the rough-and-tumble, rowdy confusion of the game. But Columbus squelches the actors in favor of action. Daniel Radcliffe gave a serious, nuanced performance in a BBC version of David Copperfield a couple of years ago, but Columbus doesn't give the kid any breathing room here. He's called upon primarily to either open his eyes in wide amazement or to grin in happy triumph. One of the great pleasures of Rowling's books is their lack of narrative drive. She's less a novelist than a writer of chapters, each of which meanders in a pleasingly rambling way. This, of course, is precisely the opposite of what's deemed essential in most Hollywood movies, what screenwriters call an emotional through line, a theme to thread through the movie, pulling it taut at the end. Columbus and screenwriter Close know what Rowling's message is. It's the same as the Beatles. All you need is love. The problem is that the movie makers don't trust in the power of such simplicity, so they waste gobs of screen time with frenetic chases and overblown special effects and some of the most intrusive, bombastic music John Williams has ever composed. Chris Columbus is already at work on adaptations of the three Potter sequels. Having gotten this polite, throat-clearing introduction out of his system, let's hope his next movies do what Rowling's books have done: become deeper, funnier, scarier.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Suze Bolan directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Thunder and Lightning, Cracking Open the Writer's Craft by Natalie Goldberg, author of Wild Mind. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the geeky kid goes to college. We talk with Judd Apatow, the creator of Undeclared, the new Fox TV comedy about a group of college freshmen. Apatow was the executive producer of the high school series Freaks and Geeks. Join us for the next Fresh Air.